Welcome to Bottom Lines, Top Dollars,
a podcast about all the money things you suspect might be ruining your life.
I'm Laura Boo, recording from the city of Charlottetown, which is on the island of Abegwik, unceded Mi'kmaq land, otherwise known as Prince Edward Island, Canada.
And I'm Hadassah Damian in Brooklyn, New York, USA, on unceded Lenape land.
Together, we are the Ladies Who Crunch, longtime friends, artists, and researchers who have both, somehow, made careers for themselves in finance.
And in this episode, we are exploring getting paid, but specifically minimum wage, living wage, and maximum wage. And I want to start this off by asking, Laura, what's your most memorable minimum wage job?
Okay, so I had a few, like most people, but I think my most memorable one was working in a souvenir shop on St. Catherine Street in downtown Montreal.
Can you help our listeners understand what that means?
Okay, so Montreal has a pretty good tourist industry, mostly based on the idea that Montreal is like Europe, but in North America, as like a very old and French-speaking city.
That is what we figure in the U.S. We're like, oh, it's working in Canada. Thank you.
Yeah. But the funny thing about this souvenir shop is that, like, you know, most people, when they think of that idea of Montreal, they would be in like the older parts of the city, like the old port and whatever. But the souvenir shop that I worked at was in like a very, at the time, grungy part of the city on St. Catherine Street, which was mostly tacky shops and strip joints, because Montreal also had like a tourism industry that was mostly based on the fact that our drinking age is only 18 and our laws around sex work are a little bit more permissive than a lot of the places in the Northeast United States. So we get a lot of college kids coming up from like Boston to have like a weekend. So, and the thing was, it was just so interesting because it was giving service to people who were coming in and they were reflecting to you their perception of what your country and city is all about in what it is that they wanted to take home with them.
We're talking about like, what, keychains, like coasters,
t-shirts. Moccasins, maple syrup, stuff like that.
Yeah, and classic Montrealer stuff. Question mark? No.
It was extra funny too, because the main person I worked with, it was this wonderful middle-aged dad named Tufik, and Tufik had arrived in Canada not that long before from Kuwait. And so it was both of us kind of like constantly dealing with what people thought Canada was. People would come in and ask for the nuttiest things, like either lumberjack shirts or Mountie hats. That was the number one, the top two requests. And then, but cool. One time someone came in and was asking Tufik for something at the front of the shop in French, and Tufik couldn't understand. So, and he looks at me and he goes, "What does this person want?" And so I speak to the person in French, and then I turn back to Tufik and I say, "She wants an axe." And he's like, "What? Axe, like to chop down a tree, an axe." And he's like, "Tell her we don't sell this." And so I was like, wow. And it was mostly for the extreme comedic gold that was that job. I loved it. I mean, I made almost nothing, and it only worked because I was a student.
I was going to say, like, what was your age? Okay, so you were in university? Yeah.
In Quebec, we have like we graduate early from high school. We only go to grade 11, and then we do 2 years of something called Cégep, which is like community college. And I was only 17 or 18, so I was living at home. I was basically just working for drinking money.
Right.
And I mean, that was kind of my most memorable one. There were so many bad ones that involved yelling matches with managers and doing things that I really didn't want to do. And in a way, I'm telling you, the one that when I look back, I'm like, that was a hilarious job.
Isn't it funny, right? Like all the jobs we've had over our lives, which are the technical content of our lives, but what you actually want to go back and write in. I think especially with minimum wage jobs, and I've had also quite a few.
So tell us your most memorable. I want to hear your most memorable.
It was my first W-2 paycheck job that I got when I was 15. How early can you start working in New York? I think 15. I was working because I was still living at home. I was a kid, but I was trying to get money for a car. And I worked in the kitchen in the infirmary of a convent. Minimum wage was $5.25 an hour. So that's what we made. And it was like just teenagers, lesbians, and ne'er-do-wells. Like that was who worked there. The shift was like 3:30 to 6. Like it was dinner shift, right? And so I would come in. So in part, people who'd started at 7 a.m. could leave. The sisters all ate at 5. And there was like basically this assembly line of food that had to get put together for them. A lot of them came down to this cafeteria room to eat it. Some of them, you know, it was an infirmary. So some of them had like very specific restricted diets. Some of them had their food sent up to their house or up to their room. I mean, like people are people, whether you're a nun or not, right? So like there were characters as well. It was like, it was the same cast. It was like Cheers, but for nuns who were sick, you know, like it, you know, so like some of them would be like trying to sneak whiskey into their coffee. Some of them were like, not about their like restricted diet food. That was like their medical prescription. And I'm like, look, I'm just a minimum wage worker. Like I can't go get you cheese.
I also had a job at a convent once, but much later.
What?
I feel like working at a convent is particularly interesting because very weird stuff happens. Like
totally.
I remember once when I was working, someone came in and asked me if I wanted my feet washed because the priests were washing feet that day. And I was like, no, I'm all right. I don't need a foot washing today.
But you know, thank you for the cultural
offering.
Thank you
offering. For the offer.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was good. So you said that minimum wage, like the very first minimum wage I ever earned was actually, I think it was $6.90, and it would have been around 97 or 98. But it very quickly, I remember, was raised to like $7.15, and I was very excited about it. You said yours was $5 and something. What year would that have been?
25 cents. This would have been 1994. 95. Yeah, when I was in the middle of high school. And I remember I got a raise after a year of working there. A dime. 10 cent. Thank you for your service. And remember, my shifts were 2-3.5 hours. So here's 35 cent a day. Thank you. Don't spend it all in one place. I guess at the time that was maybe a pack and a half of gum. And that's like the thing about, well, there's just so much we'll go into today about minimum wage jobs, but like a minimum wage raise is not impressive.
No.
Like they could double your wage and you're still like, thanks. I guess I can get a gallon of milk now.
The most recently I worked for minimum wage was about 6 years ago. And it was when I had gone back to school to become an accountant. I had a job at a workers' co-op restaurant. So I was making minimum plus tips. But even now that I no longer make minimum wage, I make quite a bit above minimum wage. Minimum wage still affects my life. Unless both you and everyone in your family and everyone that you care about are making incomes high above minimum wage, then the issue impacts you. You know, I still have family members, and not teenage family members or young adult family members. I have fully adult family members who are working to support children who are currently making minimum wage. I feel like whatever the minimum wage is in your province or for you in your state, it often is used as a baseline. It's like you're always kind of thinking, how far above minimum wage am I getting? You know?
Right, right.
I think employers often use minimum wage, even if they're paying above it, to say, oh, look, the government says this is the minimum you need.
Or the minimum that it's somehow okay to pay. And yeah, it creates this false baseline. Like from another perspective, is like as someone who might be hiring, like myself, who have our own businesses, at some point you're like, should I hire an assistant? Can I hire an assistant? How much am I going to offer to pay this person? And so I see a lot of folks in my field offering like $20 an hour. And I think that's just incredibly low, especially when you're asking for like professional assistance. But I think this is happening because minimum wage in our country is set at $7.25. So people think, oh, $20 an hour, it's so much more than minimum wage. But like $20 an hour, especially if you're an independent contractor and you're paying all these extra taxes, is really not that much money. But even $15 an hour, you know, advocacy wage that people are trying to get in the US. And that was just, you know, briefly in the most recent stimulus bill that was passed, but pulled out. So it didn't get included or move forward in our current legislation or policy. Like, there's a concept called anchoring, right? Where like when you hear a number, it kind of sticks out in your mind and you refer to it. And so minimum wage causes us to anchor to these like super low numbers that have not been reindexed for inflation in years and think, Laura, to your point, that they're appropriate. But so even $15 an hour, like when the fight for 15 started getting built, whatever, 5 years ago, it was still low. But that hasn't even been raised for inflation. Right now, it should be a fight for 20, you know, as a minimum wage, which means if you're offering to pay $20 an hour to your assistant, you're essentially offering to pay minimum wage. And I would like to invite those who are in my field to pay more than minimum wage.
I think that that anchoring is such an interesting thing. And I think that in the small businesses of friends, I think that a lot of them have started anchoring to 15 because of the fight for 15. Mm-hmm. And I actually heard somewhere that Fight for 15 was chosen because it rhymes. It was the fact that it was like a really effective sounding campaign slogan that they chose 15 as their anchor point. And in the United States, that 15 was above every single state minimum wage that there was. But even that isn't really anchored to anything super specific as far as quote unquote what people would need. And I think that this kind of leads to what is the minimum wage and how is it set? I was surprised to find out that maximum wages actually came before minimum wages, at least in the Western history that I looked at. It was right after the Black Plague killed huge swaths of people in Europe that in 1349, the king set a wage ceiling because there were so few workers left that now workers were demanding more and more because there were more jobs than there were people to do them.
Oh, it's all the invisible hand of the market until it like goes against what the king wants. That's bullshit. Okay. All right. Thank you for doing research.
So the maximum came first. And then about 30 years later, using the same set of rules in 1389, the first minimum wage or what could be thought of as a minimum wage was introduced. The king set a floor for wages pegged to the price of food. So this was kind of the first benchmark, was saying, okay, we can't pay people less than what it costs to eat.
Right. I mean, it's fascinating how it's tied to like material culture in the sense that like there wasn't a conceptualization like we have now where people have to buy clothes or people have to pay rent or people have to get other goods that we exchange money for. Because I'm assuming in like whatever 1380, you would live in your family's, you know, thatched roof hut and weave your own fabric. Like it was just a different situation.
Yeah. And so kind of jumping ahead, taking a look at the 19th century, kind of, this is like the rise of industrial capitalism. And here we started to get a lot of repeal of the minimum wage laws that had been set up in essence hundreds of years before, as there was a lot of encouragement to adopt sort of laissez-faire approach and relying on the invisible hand of the market to set wages, supply and demand. You know, if there's a type of work and there's a big supply of workers to do it and there aren't that many jobs, then the wages will fall. But this also gave rise to the labor and trade union movement, which fought for individual collective agreements. But this also kind of expanded to larger movements that would encompass not just individual workers at certain companies, but all workers. These movements saw kind of like broader solidarity that expanded beyond their own jobs to the idea that not only should they have a wage that was sufficient to support themselves and their families, but all workers should.
And this just makes me think about like, why might we need organizing to ensure that people could have enough money? Like just to drive the point home, because more and more money was required in order to meet your material needs of life, and employers were attempting to make that impossible to meet. Like in researching for this, I was reading about how Ford Auto Company like had all of these moral expectations of workers, including that workers would have their own homes, right? Would go into debt, would get mortgages. So they felt that they had to keep their jobs, but they were highly disincentivized from taking on boarders for spouses to work because they didn't want workers to have any other sources of income. They wanted workers to be like dependent on their set wages from the one employer, from that one factory. And if there's one employer in town, that's most likely who you're going to work for, unless you are one of the small number of, like now we're all like, woo, be your own boss, entrepreneurs. But like that was not really, you know, a turn of the century thing in the same way.
It's interesting to think of what there was before. Like the idea of a minimum wage is also important when you move into a model of society where the only way that you meet all your needs is through your wages. Your housing, your food, your clothing, everything is purchased rather than made. This is where the wage becomes so important and money becomes so important to people. Whereas if we go really far back, a lot of people, you know, they didn't engage in a lot of trade with money to make their lives work. I think it's important to realize that these systems, these economies that we talk about as if they're a very natural occurring thing, they're actually not how things were for a very long time. They developed because of specific things that happened. So when do we get to the point where modern minimum wages, as we know them today, started to be implemented? The first modern attempts were in New Zealand and Australia, starting in the 1890s. That was followed by the UK in 1909. Canada implemented minimum wages province by province, and that happened between 1918 and 1920. And in the United States, your minimum wage came into place around 1938. So this is kind of the timeline of when we start to see government-imposed minimum wages. And so this is beyond unions. Any single employer has to abide by these minimum wage laws.
I was going to say, side note, in the U.S., like 1938 is also when income tax was instituted for individuals. And I'm like, it must have just been like the same policy set or the same set of people, you know, because again, if you want to get money from people in the form of income taxation, you also need to ensure that people are earning a certain amount of money to make slash guarantee how much money you're going to be able to get back. Fascinating.
Yeah. And so these minimum wages, the government that are setting them are ostensibly, they're trying to balance the demands of businesses who, of course, want as low wages as possible with workers who, of course, want the highest wages possible. And the kind of way in which these are set is a very, you know, quote unquote, scientific process that involves studies of inflation and supply and demand for labor, thinking about the standard of living, looking at things like the number and the trend of how many bankruptcies are happening so that they set a minimum wage that doesn't negatively impact businesses too much while also trying to make sure that there aren't too many people living in extreme poverty. But of course, this is an extremely political process. The increase or change of the minimum wage is always very fraught. Today, at least in Canada, we have a situation where all the minimum wages in Canada are set by province. The lowest in Canada is $11.45 in Saskatchewan, and the highest in Canada is $16 in Nunavut, which for folks who might not be familiar is a territory in the north. It's one of the places in Canada with the lowest population and the highest cost of living, which might explain why their minimum wage is high in comparison to other places. But the average minimum wage for Canada across the whole country is $13.29.
Which is, quick math here, about 50% higher than what we have in the US. Okay. Because our minimum wage is $7.25. And it's been $7.25 for over a decade. And when it was set at $7.25 in 2009, I think, that was already a not very large amount of money. There's only about 390,000-400,000 people in the US who have minimum wage jobs. That number might have changed a bit due to COVID. This is 2019 numbers. But there's 40 million people in the US whose jobs make under $15 an hour. So that's essentially one in every four workers.
I think that minimum wage, its intention is to be something that helps raise wages for workers. The idea of a minimum is to say, we need to lift these folks to at least this. This is what you need and above. But I feel like what's happening right now is that minimum wage in so many places, because it hasn't grown as fast as inflation or the cost of living, has now become an anchor.
Right.
Where all these people in the United States who are working between minimum wage and $15, their wages, I think, are being dragged down by the minimum wage.
Totally. Yeah.
There's a mental thing where people are like, I am paying my workers more than minimum wage. I'm paying them this much more than minimum wage, which sounds like a really nice thing for you to be doing to your for your workers, unless you really understand that the minimum wage is actually so freaking low, so far below what people actually need. Like,
right.
For example, in Winnipeg, which is a smaller city in Canada, cost of living in that city was calculated as about $14 an hour. And, you know, this is based on what it would cost you to rent a place to live for yourself and have food and transportation, you know, essentially to exist, $14 to get by. But the minimum wage is only $11.90. That's about 15% too little to live on. That's kind of at the better end of things. There are other cities like Vancouver. They calculated that to live in Vancouver, you need about $20.10 an hour. That's what you need to earn at a full-time job to live. But the minimum wage in BC is only $14.60. And that's about 30% too little for you to have what you need to get by.
And it's kind of similar in the States and in New York City specifically. So New York City's minimum is 15, but kind of similarly, MIT researchers calculated in 2018 that a living wage in New York City would be $16 an hour for a single adult 22 for two working parents with two kids, or 40 for a single parent with two kids. Here, and again, here's the thing with the $15 minimum wage. That's $30,000 a year. Laura, I don't know about you, but I've certainly lived in my fancy city on $30,000 a year, but it hasn't been for a while. And it sure as shit wasn't easy.
Oh my God. And we did it, honestly, at the times in my life when I made the least, I literally made that happen by eating out of the garbage. Like in order to participate in my community, it didn't cost that much money because we were all on this same punk rock train of finding ways to fuck the system and live on less.
Totally. Dude, you don't need money, man. Just come to the show, pay what you can, not a fluff.
Yeah. Or like traveling by hitchhiking or train hopping, free boxes of clothes, and then wearing them until they were literally threadbare because there wasn't a lot of pressure to have nice clothes. For me, the ability to live on so little was completely, in a way, subsidized by this underground community that I was a part of. This was before my father got sick. I was young and carefree. I wasn't saving anything for the future. You know, think tanks and credit card companies create budgets for poor people where they're mm-hmm. like, this is how much we think you should be able to live off of. I am always amazed at people's ability to believe that poor people can and should be resourceful, like to the level of sainthood. They're like, you can totally eat off of $10 a day for a family of four.
Right.
A lot of these budgets that people set to determine what minimum wage should be make these assumptions about the virtue of the poorest people to basically have a life that is really crappy. Really crappy and really unhealthy, eating bad food mm-hmm. and living in very crappy places, saving nothing for their retirement.
Totally.
That's the other thing. A minimum wage leaves nothing for somebody to live off of when they reach an age where they can no longer work. There is an assumption there that you will work till you're dead.
Right. Yeah. It's like there's not really barely money in there for an emergency fund, let alone like the day when you will stop working. And there's a ton of, as one of our caller storytellers pointed out, a ton of ableism really embedded in a lot of this thinking. You can totally take the subway always. You can totally ride your bike. You can totally eat whatever GMO food and not worry about how sick it makes you. I often like go really back and forth because I want to hold on to a lot of the like working class, you know, something out of nothing magic that I feel very proud of in terms of being able to live on little. But I also want to like honor and acknowledge that it's not realistic. It's not healthy, and it doesn't create a life of sustainability, right? It's truly, truly a grind, you know. And again, I'm like two-handed on it. I'm like, on the one hand, so grateful to punk culture for having awesome no money things to do. Like that is truly part of the magic. On the other hand, I'm like, it kind of creates this slightly ageist, slightly ableist experience where if you would like to not have to bike everywhere for the next multiple decades of your life, or if you can't, or if you would like to have money for when you stop working because you would like to stop working, living at the bare minimum isn't actually sustainable. It might be feasible, right? And so I think this is where we open up into these other questions, which is, well, what else besides minimum wage should we be thinking about? There's a concept of a living wage, right? There's like the data points that you just shared, Laura, that I grabbed like for the cities, right, in the countries where we live. Now we're talking about whatever, $40,000, $50,000 a year in those cities, which is a little bit more spacious than the minimum wage at $15 an hour of $30,000 a year. So now we're adding what, like a couple doctor's visits, maybe like a week off to travel home to a parent. Maybe you're able to put away like 5% towards a retirement fund. Okay, so it's a little bit better. But something I've been fascinated in following is the research on what are the wages to ensure that your needs are covered such that you can optimize for happiness? And what are the wages needed in order to feel satisfied? The findings in the US, at least, are that like an individual, not a family, needs to make $75,000 a year to have their needs covered. And by needs and wants, like basic wants. So we're talking about, you can go to the doctor more than when your leg is falling off. You can also get preventative care. You could get the chiropractic, you know, like you could go on, you know, a vacation or two a year. You can save for the retirement. And that $75K a year, that's $37.50 an hour. Continuing onward from there, where do you maximize an income for satisfaction? The numbers from the most recent studies correlate with my own personal estimates. You need $95K a year in order to like maximize for satisfaction. So now you're in a place where you can like buy the Instagram leggings or whatever, right? You can easily donate to your Niblings college fund. Like you truly have enough to like feel satisfied within your economic experiences. $95K a year, my friends, is $47.50 an hour. So actually what we need to be doing is not a fight for 15, but a fight for 50. If we want people to feel satisfied, like they truly have enough. Like in my coaching, in my classes, I will often hear people be like, I just don't know how to calculate enough money. How am I supposed to know what I'm trying to get or save or have or this or that? What's enough? You know, adjust is needed for your own reality. But where the research is it's like actually between 75K to 95K, which means this fight for 15 is it's a start, but we need to be going so much further in our two very rich countries, the US obviously being much more of a wealth hoarder.
Don't underestimate Canadians for hoarding wealth.
Oh, I know. Look, I'm not saying you're guilt-free.
We have one of the wealthiest middle classes anywhere in the world, Canada does. Sometimes I find it so interesting to have these conversations with you because your country and my country have incredible similarities. You know, the fight for 15 right now in the United States is hot as hell. There is also a fight for increased minimum wage in Canada in many places. And I feel like I've been listening to a lot of podcasts where they get, you know, two people to come on and argue the fight for 15. They have someone come on, you know, saying, yes, we need to raise the minimum wage. And then someone coming on to argue the con side saying, no, not only do we not need a raise in minimum wage, we believe that there should be no minimum wage at all. You know, the pro side says, look, if you raise the minimum wage, it's going to be great for the economy. Why? It's going to increase economic activity and spur job growth because you're injecting more money into the pockets of the poorest people in this country. And in general, people who make the least amount of money, they're also the people who spend money very fast.
Yeah, because it's going like to pay bills. It's going to like the phone company, the electric company, right? Like it's going to the landlord. Sure, that money goes back into the economy, but it, in some ways, raising the minimum wage from that point of view is merely just like giving more money to the owner class.
But then the con side says, actually raising the minimum wage would be bad for the economy because raising the minimum wage will mean that employers will have to decrease the hours of workers and lay off workers because they won't be able to afford those wages, which means that actually the poorest people will lose work and therefore they will have nothing to spend. So when I look at it, I'm like, okay, they're making exactly opposite arguments saying that this thing will do exactly opposite things. Pretending like economics is like a chemical science where if you add this element to this element, the shit explodes, or you add this element to this element and you get gold. And I'm like, people trying to make economic projections of if I turn this dial, then this will happen, sometimes feels like people doing psychic work almost, you know, because there are two different people predicting exactly opposite effects. And they're really just campaigning those effects and those data points to their political base.
Totally. I think it really frames the issue in brutalist ways that aren't super comprehensible. Like if someone rolls up and is like, do you want 1 million poor people to be out of work? Like I would kind of be like, no, but what's the other option? Like, will they get UBI instead? So then maybe yes, you know, like these arguments, the current data-based arguments, like, yes, I'm all about evidence and facts, please. But they then draw the conclusions that nothing could be done about it. Or they draw the conclusions as if like the thing that's going to happen is going to happen in the conditions of today and nothing will be done and nothing will, right? No one's going to get help. There won't be any additional thing that happens, which is silly. Like the last year and a half has shown that like our governments can absolutely respond to crises with money and other things. again, like, what if minimum wage or even like living wages are the wrong way to think about it? Not that I'm against people getting more money. I'm 100% for it. But what if the way to do that is actually a maximum wage, right? And so there's this like really interesting history in the US where we just totally tend to forget the way things were 10 years ago. But if we look back basically two generations, like in the early 1930s, the taxes for like the most highly paid people. So at that time, if you made 200K or more a year, which in the 1930s was, but like I'm sure today's multimillionaire. So if you were extremely well paid, your tax rate was first 70%. And then by the early 1940s, 90%. And so effectively what that is like a tax-based maximum wage because you are extremely disincentivized from earning more money once you're at that point, which again, very, very few people were. But the idea is that like if a company is considering increasing the pay of a CEO, right? One of the few companies of people who are already paid that much to get an extra $100 in the pocket of that person, you have to pay them an extra $1,000, 90% of which goes to taxes. Therefore, what the company is incentivized to do instead is to redistribute that money among lower paid, like middle managers or other workers who will be able to keep more of that money, right? So like from just like a net-net perspective, like where does the money go? More people keep it if we don't give it to our highest paid employees, which is a way to think about incentivizing organizations to pay workers more. And like through the 1960s, that was the tax rate in the US. It was lowered to 70% in like the late 60s by Kennedy. And then once Reagan came in, he like dropped it way back down. But for the majority of one of what's considered to be the most like the one of the biggest periods of wealth creation in US history, the top tax rate effectively created a maximum wage. And I think that we should not imagine that that could be impossible for it to come back.
You know, the minimum wage is this thing where at some point society decided that even the people who are the most vulnerable in our society should be protected in some way. And this was the mechanism that people put in. A lot of people think this is our only option. And I'm like, it's not our only option. It's something that we came up with 100 years ago. And, you know, people are fighting so hard for it because it's one of the few protections for workers that are left standing. But there are other tools, is what I'm saying. And we've lost those tools. Like unionization is such a hard fight now. And I get why people are like, we need to fix the minimum wage. This is one lever we have to pull. Right now, the power of workers in the world has been so battered and so diminished. The power of the bosses is so disproportionately high compared to the power of the workers. Minimum wage is one way to try to kind of tip that scale, but there are other things like having UBI. If everybody is getting that minimum to survive, it evens the scales a little bit between workers and employers on setting their wage because you will not have as much worker desperation. Worker desperation leads to employers taking advantage of people. Other options are wage subsidies and tax breaks. Like, why not a higher level of income under which you do not pay any taxes? I mean, in Canada, the first $13,000 you make, there's no income tax on that. And then you're taxed in tiers. But that $13,000 is so low. No one can live on $13,000.
You know, the assumption is like, well, why don't you just eat out of the garbage?
It is.
You know, and look, if you're some like crust punk, great, you're eating out of the garbage and you don't care because you're getting to avoid money. You're actively opting into that. But if the assumption, right, is that you should just do that because that's what you have to do to survive, that's brutal.
If it costs somebody in your country absolute minimum to live $30,000, I'm throwing a random number out. If you make less than that, then you know what? The government shouldn't be taking a piece. You know, from someone like you or I who make way more than that, the idea is our first $13,000 isn't taxed, and then our next chunk of 30 is taxed at this tax rate, and then your next chunk of 30 is taxed at this higher rate. And that's how we actually calculate how much you pay the government. You know, I'm not saying, hey, my first $30,000 should be untaxed. I make a good living and I believe that I should pay into the system more than other people because I believe that we should all have at least enough to be taken care of. And I think that those who have privilege need to spread around that privilege.
Totally. And there's like right now in the US, there is a proposal on the table that's called a wealth tax. That's like been put forward by Elizabeth Warren and some other progressive Democrats to essentially tax not the income, but the held wealth of the most rich people in the US. The proposal is if you have more than $50 million in assets, and what's radical based on our current system is that that would include basically anything you have control over. So money in trusts, money in the US and outside of the US, money, you know, wherever you might have, whatever corner you might have stuck it into, like it still counts. And so if you have over $50 million, you'll pay 2% tax. If you have over $1 billion, you would pay a 6% tax. The idea is that you're disincentivized from holding over $1 billion because the tax at that point would take the majority of any possible earnings that you have. The idea is that the money doesn't just like accumulate in like the coffers, you know, in like the sort of gold hoards of wealthy individuals, but that it circulates back, right? And so, yeah, you're right, Laura. There's all these different things that could be incentivized about how the money moves. Like our world is not without money. Our world is without money moving to a majority of people. Right. Like, and if we were to reframe the problem in that way, then it becomes, yeah, it's about minimum wage as a solution, not the problem or fight itself.
Yeah. The system as it's set up is such that the resources of the world are continually being sucked up into the hands of fewer and fewer. And the fight for 15 is one fight to start pulling some of that money back towards the people who are making the lowest amount.
A little dribble.
To me, the idea that there are people who are fighting so viciously against just $15 is truly, truly terrifying. And I think that one of the problems here is that the arguments are framed in these very black and white pro and con arguments that they essentially say, look, people are not making enough to live. They need to make more. And the other side says, if you pay them more, small businesses will go under. Businesses will fail.
Because as a country, we'll refuse to help small businesses to punish them for having the audacity to pay workers enough. Like, it's such a brutal assumption within that argument. I hate it.
And that's the place where they're arguing is the small business. They're using right. The small business as this shield, this armor, yeah. Where they're like, you cannot throw the small business under the bus. And I'm like, okay, guys, it's not about them.
Look, I'm like, look, don't Main Street camouflage me.
It's about Walmart. It's about Walmart. It's about McDonald's.
It is about the fucking Waltons and how much money they hoard. It straight up is the Waltons family. You need to give some back. You have gotten rich with more money than you need, taking from your workers the value they have created for you. Give some back. It's that simple.
And there's ways, like people acting as if you cannot increase the minimum wage because it'll sacrifice small businesses. Mm. Therefore, we need to allow the Walmarts of the world to continue to basically take extreme advantage of their workers. This, to me, is taking the little guy and using them as a shield to protect mm-hmm. the big guy. And I'm totally. There are other ways that we could create systems by which we are focusing this redistribution where there is the most hoarding. I listen to books while I exercise in the morning, and I was listening to the book Saving Capitalism by Robert Reich. And my best friend sent me this text message. I have this vision of you as like Canadian Psycho rowing madly while hate listening to this book. And I was like, well, you know, I feel like it's really important for me as an anti-capitalist to get as much information and ideas as possible. And this book, basically the first half of it is reading capitalism to filth. And the whole time I'm listening, I'm like, yep, 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 yep. And then the second half of the book is, and this is how we save capitalism. This is how we recuperate and maintain this system. So, you know, it was an interesting read for me, but there was or several ideas that were forwarded in this book that I thought were super interesting. And one was concepts for a system of maximum wages, banding or tying the highest paid worker's wage to the lowest paid worker's wage in any corporation or any business. Let's say 30 years ago, in general, the CEO or the CFO was paid 20 times what the lowest worker made, or maybe 30. But nowadays, most CEOs and the highest paid workers at companies make more like hundreds of times what the lowest worker makes. So that you have the lowest worker at a company making, you know, $25,000 or $30,000 a year, and the CEO is making like hundreds of millions of dollars in a year. And this concept was saying, look, we can create incentives through corporate taxation that say your CEO's pay should be in the range of this many X to this many X, the lowest paid worker. So if your corporate tax rate is 10%, and you fall within the ideal range, your CEO makes 20 to 30 times what the lowest paid worker makes, then you get to keep that good tax rate. If your CEO makes more than that, makes 70, 80, 100 times what your lowest paid worker makes, well, then your corporate tax rate is going to go up. It's going to go up to 12 or 14 or 15%. On the other side, if you actually narrow that gap, you make it only 10 times, then actually we will reward you with a lower corporate tax rate. We'll lower your tax rate to 8% or 7%. So what that does is it incentivizes the company to raise the lowest wages in their company. And that would potentially work for a large company like Walmart or McDonald's.
Or it would also work for a small company. Like when we come back to this like Main Street baiting that's been happening, you could, you know, for that Main Street company where, you know, I hire someone at minimum wage and I only make a couple bucks more an hour than them. Okay, well now our ratio is like 0.5. And so I'm rewarded with an even lower tax break, or maybe I get like a incentive program, right? Like a tax incentive program because of that smaller ratio. Again, when we're talking about raising taxes, people sometimes pearl clutch, but this tax rate comes in for companies that pay their CEOs 100X and up of what the lowest paid worker makes, right? Same thing with this like wealth tax. We're talking about if your family has $50 million or if you have $50 million. Like the impacts are on people who are already really quite economically fine. So for example, another place where there's a wage cap, a maximum wage, is the NBA, is basketball. The highest paid basketball players are still paid quite a lot of money. They are good. But the ratio there is 20 to 1. So the highest paid people are paid at most 20 times what the lowest paid people are who aren't actually paid that low. What you have then is more money spread among more people. But the other thing that you have, and I think this is super interesting, and to me, I'm like, we're so focused on like having money, getting money, spending money, because there's so much pain and scarcity and like people not being able to meet their basic needs, right? So just to name that. But it means that we don't focus on some of the more humane and human elements, like doing a job you like and being good at it and like getting to enjoy your day-to-day day, or getting to like experience expertise, or the like fun competition, as opposed to like the sort of scarcity fear grind that can keep some people in jobs, right? And so in basketball, you know, like I was reading this Vox article that kind of talks about basketball and CEOs. And it's like, look, when we saw maximum wage, or see it in this one example, what we actually see is at the top for these highest performers, now the motivation isn't make more money, which is extrinsic motivation. The motivation is intrinsic motivation, which is be awesome at what you do and win because you're good, which is a really different way of motivating people to take part in work or jobs or whatever. And I'm sure I've kind of touched on it in other podcasts, because it's so interesting to me that we are in such a financialized time, and there's so much that people need that a large portion of the population doesn't have because of money, that we just focus on money solving the problem. And we forget all the other elements that are at play that make us fully human. Why do we want money? So we can participate in life, so we can have other things happening.
Yeah, but what you're talking about is a world in which people are all in a state of having enough. And yes, then you just have the scale is then between people who have enough and people who have more than enough.
Yes, this is the wild idea I'm putting forward that I would love to see.
But the situation that we're in right now is a situation where there is an extreme amount of have-nots, and we're debating their right to exist against the rights of people who have way too much being able to keep that. You know, when people say things like there is a witch hunt against the rich, to kind of use a Trumpian word, witch hunt, number one, I'm like, so I'm like, a part of me is like, yeah, I truly believe that having a million times more than you and all your descendants could ever need is a failure of society and needs to be rectified. It just needs to. And I think that this fight for 15 is, honestly, I think it's people fighting for their lives at the very, very bottom. And a part of me is like, yes, we absolutely, at very minimum, we need this. And then we need a whole bunch of other things because it really doesn't even go far enough.
Exactly.
And this is where I'm at for minimum wage.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. It is beyond like a ethical minimum to raise the minimum wage in both our countries and beyond. But we must remember that that's not the ultimate problem that we're trying to solve. Like wealth inequality and the ways in which it forces desperation on many people and incentivizes insularity and greed with a few is the problem. Of course, we'll talk about more of these topics and others in upcoming episodes. Thank you, dear listener. Laura, I love these combos with you. Oh my goodness.
Oh my God, I'm so excited about season two. It's great to be talking to you again.
Yeah, you're.
See you soon.
Okay.
This has been another episode of Bottom Lines, Top Dollars, a podcast made by queer punks and anti-capitalist finance professionals who, like you, don't trust money.
And are therefore obsessed with understanding it.
Your hosts are the Ladies Who Crunch. That's me, Laura Boo.
And me, Hadassah Damian from Ride Free Fearless Money. Folks, if you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and review us on whatever podcast app you use. And speaking of money, if you are able, throw us a few bucks at patreon.com/bottomlinestopdollars.
Funds from our Patreon will pay for the costs of making and distributing this podcast, and if we grow this project big enough, for the cost of getting help to make this.
Oh, I love help and I love getting to pay for it. But other free things you can do is support us by following us on social media. We're on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Just search for Bottom Lines Top Dollars or Ladies Who Crunch.
We also have a website where we publish show notes on our blog at ladieswhocrunch.club.
Finally, if you have questions to submit for our end of season listener mail episode or feedback for us, or if you just have your own punk money stories to share, you can email us at bottomlinestopdollars@gmail.com or just find us on one of the social media platforms and message us there.
We'd like to thank our listeners and friends who have contributed to the show, and especially to our researchers and idea sounding boards, Ariel Federo and Handy Levine.
And remember, friends, punk's not dead, but capitalism still sucks. And if what you heard in this podcast sounded familiar, you're not alone. Thanks for listening.